live from the great American Northwest. It's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gray. Drop what
you're doing. Airline passengers might want to consider a trip to the gym before heading to the airport now that high-tech body scanners have been unveiled at Kennedy Airport. This is from the New York Daily News from yesterday. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano yesterday hailed them as an important breakthrough for airport security and in the fight against terrorism. Yet when it came to testing the devices, which produce chalky, naked X-ray images of passengers, she turned the floor over to some brave volunteers. These machines represent an important way to stay ahead of the ever-evolving threat that faces the aviation industry, Napolitano said. About 300 of the advanced imaging technology AIT machines are operational today, already at 62 airports across the country, and 450 will be in place by the end of the year, officials said. JFK will have a substantial number, but officials would not reveal the exact figure. Nor would Janet Napolitano reveal her figure by way of the backscatter technology. Well, I suppose we should thank God for aesthetic favors, but the gravamen of this story is that she didn't want to have inflicted on her what her subordinates inflict on those of us, mere mundanes who fly. She's one of the animals that's just a little bit more equal than the others, as part of the presiding elite. Just something to think about here. I really don't have any interest at all whatsoever anymore in commercial aviation for another whole host of reasons that have nothing to do with backscatter porno scanners. I don't like the fact that we're treated, as I've said before, as if we were being taken into Fort Leavenworth prison every time we go into an airport, let alone get on an airplane. So there are a number of reasons why I've got no interest at all in flying commercially, but this, of course, is the proverbial nail in the equally proverbial coffin. Here's something I've shared with you before. At least if you've been listening to this program longer than the last several months, you've no doubt heard me refer to Yakov Smirnov. Yakov Smirnov is one of those living trivia questions that would be recognizable, I suppose, his name, his identity, his shtick, to people of a certain age. Those of us in our mid-40s would remember him from the 1980s as part of the late Cold War fusion of popular culture and politics. I met Yakov Smirnov. He's a delightful man. At least he was when I met him. This was in about 1986, I think, when I was attending Utah State University. He went on stage the evening to perform his comedy routine, but the afternoon of his appearance there, he was the featured speaker at a convocation, which was a more serious engagement. Rather than giving a speech, he simply took questions. And I found him to be very charming, very small. I think he's probably only about 5'4", 5'5". But he was talking about his experiences growing up as sort of a quasi-refusnik, a Soviet Jew who was treated very badly by that government, which, of course, was formerly atheist and collectivist in ways that very few other regimes have been. And he was deliriously in love with the United States. He admitted that the United States had flaws then and, of course, has flaws now. But he said, when you're in love, you tend to overlook flaws, which I thought was a very perceptive and very charitable answer. And I had the opportunity after the show to talk to him in person and told him I really enjoyed his remarks. Anyhow, Yakov Smirnov had a very abrupt end to his career in 1991 when the Soviet Union was formally disbanded in name. That is to say, it went into receivership and came out under a new label with the same management. This is a really interesting state of affairs because the same people are running post-Soviet Russia who were running the Soviet Union back in before December of 1991. But they're practicing a slightly less aggressive form, but pretty much the same philosophy. But Yakov Smirnov saw a very abrupt end to his career, and last I heard he was exiled to Branson, Missouri. What is it about Missouri this evening? Anyhow, one of his comic routines involved the question, what do you like about the United States? And he said, I like the fact that here in the United States, the police fire warning shots, because in Russia, the police simply shoot somebody, and that's considered a warning to the rest of us. Now, I thought that was a funny line in 1986. In 2010, not so much. Whatever happened to warning shots? Whatever happened to the practice of police knocking on a door when they're going to serve a warrant, rather than going to a judge on the basis of an anonymous single complaint by a paid informant, a liar for hire, getting a no-knock warrant and then kicking in the door in order to deal with usually trivial amounts of a controlled substance that shouldn't be criminalized in the first place? Just what the hell is this all about? There was a time when police, even dealing with murder suspects or people who were involved in armed robberies or other unambiguous crimes that are mala in se, that is to say they are wrong in and of themselves, positive violations of absolute law as opposed to mala prohibita, things that are simply forbidden by public enactments that the government wants us to treat as if they had the same stature but don't. It's the difference between armed assault on the one hand and jaywalking on the other. That's the difference between a malum in se and a malum prohibitum. But it used to be that even when police were dealing in exigent circumstances with somebody who's actually been accused of or caught in the act of committing a crime against another human being, they would surround the house and demand surrender of the suspect rather than going barging into a home, guns blazing, and treating everybody inside as an enemy combatant. But now you have the latter scenario playing out, even in trivial circumstances, where you're dealing with inconsequential amounts of narcotics or things that are called narcotics, such as marijuana, which is not actually a narcotic. This is from Longview, Texas. Brothers recall SWAT team break-in. Two brothers say they were in for a rude awakening when officers with the city's SWAT team rushed their home in the middle of the night. Now, that's literally out of Soviet Russia. That's the proverbial 3 a.m. knock on the door, except they don't even knock on the door now. They just kick it in. Kenneth and James Jimerson, I believe it's Jimerson, were pulled from their bed, put in handcuffs, and taken from their home. I heard a big, loud commotion and a big, loud boom, and before I could raise out of bed, they were in on me. The police had guns drawn on me and told me to get down. I thought originally a car had run into the house or somebody was breaking in, said Kenneth. Well, somebody did break in. I mean, you're dealing here with a situation in which you have armed robbers, or the moral equivalent of armed robbers, because they had no legal right to be there. While Kenneth and James waited in handcuffs, officers searched their home. One had a gun right in my head. A guy told me, don't look at me, look away from me. I done what he told me, said James. Now think about the psychology involved in this for a second. You can't even look them in the eyes without it being considered some form of, threat? Some form of resistance, rebellion? Honestly, they expect people to behave as chastened serfs. The SWAT team didn't find anything in the brothers' home. Turns out the officers had invaded the wrong home. And in the course of doing so, they held these two people at gunpoint, and they're lucky that they got an apology. Actually, they're lucky they didn't get their heads blown off. Oh, boy. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute. So you have these two guys in Longview, Texas, who are just minding their own business, and suddenly there's what sounds like a huge explosion, and the cops come boiling in, dragging these guys out of their beds, holding them at gunpoint. One of them snarls at one of his victims, don't look at me, look away from me, as if, what, the guy's committing some kind of an aggressive act by looking at his assailant. The SWAT team didn't find anything in the brother's home. Turns out the officers invaded the wrong home. This is from KLTV, which is a network affiliate in Longview, Texas. They came back and said, apparently we have made a mistake, said Kenneth. Kenneth being one of the two who was mistreated this way. When the SWAT agents exited their vehicle, they were distracted by people on the street. They went to the house they thought was 825 when it was 823, says Longview Assistant Police Chief Don Dingler. The city has apologized to the Jemersons. The police department has launched an internal investigation to make sure nothing like this happens again. Well, there's a very easy way to avoid this kind of an outcome. Get a routine search warrant next time and knock on the damn door. Obviously, they weren't dealing here with a situation that involved somebody being held hostage. They weren't looking for somebody who was suspected of a violent crime. They conducted a dynamic entry because that is the preferred mode of operation in dealing with a narcotics warrant. Otherwise, the evidence will be flushed down the toilet and they can't make the case. You see, the Fourth Amendment doesn't recognize convenience of the prosecution as a valid reason for authorizing a home invasion. See, we don't think in terms of making life easier for the police and the prosecutors. Because when you do that, you end up with this type of an outcome. And multiply this by, something like the cube root of infinity, and you've got a pretty good description of what's going on everywhere in this country right now. And what really frosts me is that in circumstances of this sort, people get killed on both ends of the equation. People get hurt or people get killed because of dynamic entries that are not justified by the need to protect somebody, which, of course, is supposed to be the whole rationale for having government law enforcement in the first place. It doesn't work that way, but that's what we're told is the intention. This is another story on a similar theme. A 31-year-old man was sentenced to 5 years in prison Monday shortly after pleading guilty to shooting two narcotics detectives when they tried to execute a no-knock search warrant at his North Baton Rouge home in 2008. State District Judge Chip Moore also ordered Ellis Henry Jr. to be put on active supervised probation for 5 years after he is released from prison. Henry allegedly fired 9 shots at East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office detectives from inside his home at 2569 73rd Avenue, according to an affidavit of probable cause. One deputy was hit in the knee and another was shot in the calf. The deputy was also struck in the chest but was wearing a bulletproof vest, sheriff's officials said, after the shooting about midnight on August 5, 2008. Henry initially was booked on 6 counts of attempted first-degree murder because 6 deputies involved in the execution of the search warrant were in his line of fire. Think about that for a second. They're armed. At least some of them are wearing body armor, but supposedly they're potential murder victims. You could have killed 2 people, Moore said, of the 2 deputies Henry shot. You probably could have killed more than that. The judge said 2 weapons, a 9mm handgun and an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, seized during the search are to be forfeited, which is to say stolen, and or destroyed. Moore noted that a 70-round magazine of ammunition was also found in Henry's home. That's something you have in Vietnam, not inside your house, the judge told Henry. We're not in a war here. Seems like we are. Well, no duh, Your Honor. When you have people conducting dynamic entries in the war on drugs, we are in a war zone. When people are treated as enemy combatants rather than citizens clothed in constitutional rights, from the perspective at least of the law enforcement officers who assault them, it does seem like we're in a war zone. And that's a pretty good argument, I think, to armor up if you're a citizen. Henry declined Moore's invitation to address the court, pleaded guilty to a charge of aggravated assault upon a police officer with a firearm. He was indicted last year on 2 counts of attempted second-degree murder, 1 count of illegal use of weapons, and 1 count of possession with intent to distribute cocaine. East Baton Rouge Parish District Attorney Hillar Moore III said his office had thoroughly reviewed the case in preparation for a trial that was supposed to start Monday. We believe this is the best outcome, he said, noting that Henry is a first-time offender and that there were some inconsistencies in the statements of lay witnesses. I'd be willing to bet that there were inconsistencies on the part of the professional witnesses, too, the police officers. Now we come to the meat of the story. The district attorney also said Henry made a 911 call during the encounter. Tom D'Amico, one of Henry's attorneys, told the judge that Henry lives in a high-crime area. D'Amico said after court, that Henry and his fiancée thought the detectives were burglars. He did not know it was police officers breaking down his door, D'Amico added. How do you solve this problem? Hello, this is the police. Open up. We have a search warrant. That's how you solve the problem. It really isn't that difficult to understand. You knock on the door and you announce. You don't kick in the door, point guns at whoever's in there and say, search warrant. That's not serving a search warrant. That's a home invasion robbery. And I'd rather deal with commonplace burglars. Once again, to paraphrase Edmund Burke, I'd rather deal with lawless, outright lawless men than lawless men who claim to be embodying the law, because the former I can defend myself against, but if you start up with the latter, they and their colleagues will waste their lives trying to ruin or take yours from you. That's a rather generous paraphrase of Burke's comments. Henry's fiance, Crystal McGee, said after the shooting that the men were dressed in plain clothes, did not knock, and did not identify themselves until after shots were fired. Sheriff's officials disputed those statements, of course they would, saying after the shooting that the deputies wore vests with sheriff written on them in yellow. Well, you know what? Anybody can get a vest that says that. And one of the things that's happening right now is that because the police are behaving like common street thugs are starting to behave like the police who imitate them. There's really an Orwellian pigmen dialectic going on between, well, the thugs and the pigs. They're thug pigs. They're pig thugs. You have home invasion robberies being carried out by the police, so home invasion robbers start posing as police. In the serene confidence that by doing so, most people are going to look at the accoutrements of law enforcement and assume that these violent, lawless men who are breaking into their home and threatening them with lethal violence are doing so with the imprimatur of the state. Let's see. Sheriff's officials disputed those statements, saying after the shooting that the deputies wore vests with sheriff written on them in yellow, shouted search warrant in sheriff's office while they knocked on the door with a battering ram. We knocked on the door with a battering ram. We only knocked once. And used emergency lights from two patrol vehicles to illuminate the house. We had some conflicting testimony that that wasn't the case, D'Amico said. D'Amico added that the sheriff's office and Henry could have handled the situation better. The affidavit of probable cause says the detectives obtained the no-knock search warrant after a confidential informant bought suspected crack from the victim. Once again, perfect example, museum-quality example of the way that this so-called war on drugs is actually a war on individual liberties and a war on the Fourth Amendment, inter alia. Because you got a situation here where a guy shot a couple of police detectives, and thankfully none of them was killed. This isn't like the case of Corey May in Prentice, Mississippi from 2001, where a no-knock drug raid ended up being staged at the wrong address, and Corey May, roused from his slumber by a party of armed men in his home without permission, grabbed his gun and shot and killed one of them, and then he was originally sentenced to die for defending himself against a lawless invasion conducted as part of this war on drugs against the wrong address. It's just perverse, staggeringly perverse. Apparently he had the duty to die. They have the privilege, the unqualified privilege to kill, and we have the unqualified duty to die from the perspective of the people running this perfectly insane war. And it is a literal war. That's one of the reasons why people have clips that can hold 70 rounds for their AR-15 rifles. And really, we don't need the permission of some chair-moistening time server who wears a dress to work to own that type of armament. And if you're a Second Amendment maximalist like myself, the operative principle is that you should have superior firepower over those who presume to be our servants, or at least should be our servants. This is Will Gregg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute or two. Once again, the question I have here is a variation on Yakov Smirnov's idea of the advantage, the comparative advantage, between law enforcement in the United States, at least circa 1985, and law enforcement in the Soviet Union, and that is the fact that in the United States, at least in 1985, police still fired warning shots. Now, elaborating on that insight just a little bit, we end up with the following understanding, and that is that under the heading of warning shots, we should include everything having to do with the immunities and protections encapsulated in the Fourth Amendment and its cognate enactments in the state constitutions of the separate states, such as they are. It's really a misnomer to refer to states as states anymore. They're administrative units for Trantar, or for Mordor, however you want to characterize the feculent imperial capital in Washington, D.C. that actually runs things. But the point is that police have to get permission. Government agents have to get permission before they intrude on private property. They can do so by consent, or they can obtain a permission slip from a judge. And that's what a warrant is, essentially is. It's a permission slip. It is a trivial, ephemeral form of protection, but at least it is a procedural impediment that's supposed to protect people from unjustified assaults on their person, of the sort that I describe frequently here. These poor brothers down in Longview, Texas, who are literally rousted in the middle of the night by police who kicked in their door without announcing their presence or explaining who they were. That's exactly the sort of thing that the Fourth Amendment was supposed to prevent. That's the sort of thing that went on in a less aggressive form in New England during the 1760s and 1770s leading up to American independence. Why don't police knock and announce? Here's a variation on that same insight again. Why don't police retreat and regroup in circumstances where it's likely that somebody's going to die needlessly? If you're dealing with a situation in which a police officer is afraid for his life, or he's involved in some kind of a no-knock search warrant, which I think no-knock search warrants should not be issued, period, full stop. If you're dealing with exigent circumstances, you don't need a no-knock search warrant. But a search warrant basically should be, in all circumstances, a knock-and-announce situation, a knock-and-announce proposition. But if you're dealing with a situation where a police officer is hot in pursuit, you know, he's Officer Stadenko, he's the narcotics officer from the Cheech and Chong albums, the Cheech and Chong films, and he's panning after a big bust, and suddenly he finds himself confronted by a suspect, a homeowner, a subject, who may have something that looks like a weapon. Why doesn't the police officer withdraw and then announce who he is as a way of avoiding an outcome that will result in somebody getting hurt or killed? Why don't they do that? The answer is they're not trained to do that. They're trained with a paramilitary mindset, which involves conquering and holding territory and dealing with people on the receiving end of their attentions as enemy combatants rather than as American citizens. That's something which doesn't necessarily have a connection with what the government does overseas in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen, heavenly knows where else. That has to do with the fact that in the 1970s, the Nixon administration domesticated, meaning it rendered domestic, the warfare state through the war on drugs. And here, once again, is a perfectly splendid specimen of a needless death brought about by this mindset. Dateline, Roy, Utah. This is from October 20th from KSL Radio and Television in Salt Lake City. Weber County Attorney D. Smith says a police officer was justified in the fatal shooting of a club-wielding man in a September 16th raid that turned up a half ounce of marijuana. He was killed over half an ounce of marijuana. I don't know a whole lot about marijuana, but I doubt that you could catch a really good buzz off of half an ounce of marijuana. Now, he says club-wielding man, and that conjures up images of something that alley-oop might be using, or perhaps the 38-ounce monstrosity the Babe Ruth used to use back at the end of the dead ball era and the beginning of the live ball era in the 1920s, or perhaps the proverbial shillelagh that was the constant sidearm of your stereotypical Irish cop. No, it was a golf club. Tuesday's ruling came after family members said the raid caught 45-year-old Todd E. Blair of Roy by surprise in his basement. They said Blair probably thought he was confronting burglars. You know, that's what happens when police officers behave like criminals. The people on the receiving end of their attentions believe they're dealing with criminals. Smith says, that is D. Smith, the Weber County prosecutor, says Roy Police Sergeant Troy Burnett had little time to react to a man brandishing a golf club and was justified in firing three times. A sister, Towna Blair Gosberg, has told the Standard Examiner of Ogden that her brother was a gentle handyman who took in strangers and once paid to fly a friend across country to escape a life of drug addiction. She says he wasn't selling meth or heroin, as alleged in a search warrant, and died with $4 in his pocket. Now, for me, the key data points here are the following. This was a no-knock search warrant. There should never be no-knock search warrants. Second point is that the police officer apparently recognized he was confronting somebody armed with a golf club, which is not a lethal weapon. The third point is that he fired three times. Why didn't he retreat? Apparently, the shot was fired from a distance of 10 to 12 feet. He fired three times. Now, this isn't exactly a split-second proposition either, because this guy had to come up from his basement. He wasn't charging at the officer. He wasn't a blur of motion. He had to come up from the downstairs, and apparently he had his club hoisted over his head because he was confronting an armed stranger in his home. Why didn't the police officer withdraw? Why didn't he seek cover? Why didn't he tell the man to freeze? There are options here that don't involve pumping lead into somebody who is essentially harmless and, for all intents and purposes, unarmed. If you bring a golf club to a gunfight, you're going to come in a very poor second. Here's another version of the same story. Police say an officer had no choice. That's nonsense. That is a big reeking pile of used food. Oh, the agonized reluctance. Oh, the tormented conscience of the heroic paladin of public order. He had no choice but to fire. He had a whole menu of choices. He just didn't make any of them. His only safe option, as far as he was concerned, was open gunplay. Had no choice but to open fire on a man who confronted them during a drug raid at a Roy home Thursday night. It was last September. The 45-year-old man died after officers shot him. Police say when officers entered the home, the man inside threatened an officer with a golf club. That suspect had a club, had it raised above his head, went towards the officer in an attacking motion, says Roy Police Chief Greg Winham. Had the officer not made a decision and taken action at that moment that he did, there would have been grave results. Note the use of the subjunctive mood there. There would have been grave results. Apparently, a dead 45-year-old man who's not wearing a government-issued costume isn't the sort of thing that the police chief considers to fall within the category of grave results. It's literally a grave result. The guy's mortal remains are in a grave now. The officer fired at the man, killing him. That officer is currently being questioned about the incident. The shooting occurred just before 10 p.m. Thursday at a home near 5900 South and 2600 West in Roy. A joint drug task force had been conducting an ongoing investigation there for several weeks. Police had information that drugs would be at the house Thursday night, so they served a search warrant just as a vehicle was leaving the house. They say when they entered the home and confronted the man inside, the shooting suddenly went down. Boy, I hate that type of mock tough verbiage. Winham says one of the members of the house, members of the house, that's an odd phrasing, came toward one of the officers in a manner which threatened the officer. The officers had to use deadly force to subdue the suspect. The suspect has died, and we're just beginning the investigation. Such antiseptic language. The officers had to use deadly force to subdue the suspect. The guy had a golf club. They were able to recognize it was a golf club. There were two of them. There were two of them. He had a golf club. Don't you think you could subdue the suspect without shooting him three times? But once again, officer safety is the paramount consideration here. It's not the use of justifiable force. It's certainly not the protection of somebody who is a suspect. And in this case, he was a suspect in a crime that didn't involve violence, that shouldn't be a crime in the first place, but even under the statutes that exist right now, he wasn't accused of doing something that involved violence. The thing that I find really sickening about this is the reaction of the neighbors once this happened. They were interviewed by the local television news, and several of them said, oh yeah, we expected something like this to happen because we thought that bad things were going on at the home. We thought there were bad things going on at this address. Well, there weren't bad things going on until the police showed up and killed the guy in cold blood. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. Stand by for further flights of rhetorical excess after this. System memory crash.
to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gray.
Oh, once again, about this case in Aurora, Utah, where you had this 45-year-old guy who was gunned down by police in his home, came up from the basement, a couple of police officers who were serving a no-knock drug enforcement warrant. They eventually found half an ounce of marijuana in his apartment. The warrant didn't specify marijuana. They were looking for crack. They're looking for meth and, I believe, for crack. I can't remember for sure. But anyhow, they were looking for something other than marijuana. They didn't find anything but this trivial amount of marijuana. This fellow, on one occasion, according to his sister, at his own expense, had paid to fly a friend of his across the country to a treatment facility to deal with her drug addiction. And he had been arrested many years ago on a drug possession charge. So he's somebody who had weaknesses, and they should be looked at as weaknesses. If he lived in a more enlightened country, say Portugal, which decriminalized all drugs 10 years ago, this fellow would have been offered but not compelled to undergo treatment for his addiction rather than being treated as a criminal because of his drug possession. If he were dealing narcotics, he might find himself on the receiving end of prosecutorial action. But Portugal, and bear in mind, Portugal is a conservative Catholic country. As an Iberian Catholic country, it's conservative and it's Catholic in a way that very few other countries in Europe could be considered conservative or Catholic. It's not that long ago, maybe about 40 years ago, that they had a very authoritarian government under Salazar. It was sort of like Franco Spain light. It was like a low-calorie version of Franco's quasi-falangist reign in Spain that became a Spanish monarchy and now, unfortunately, has become pretty much a standard Euro-trash, Euro-weenie socialist member of the European Union, alas. I mean, Spain was actually better off when Franco was running it in many ways than it is today. But Portugal was sort of the little brother, the junior sibling to Franco's Spain. So you're dealing with a country that's deeply authoritarian in its moral and religious outlook, although, unfortunately, not necessarily of strong character in terms of the aggregate public behavior of the Portuguese. But in Portugal, 10 years ago, they were confronting the cultural consequences of a deeply entrenched problem of drug use and drug addiction, and an even bigger problem in the form of drug enforcement. They had the worst of all possible worlds. And so, as a matter of concerted public policy and perhaps something they consider to be something of a last resort, they decriminalized possession and use of narcotics. They created a system in which people who had a documentable drug addiction could be brought before a board of medical advisors for diagnosis. And if the board of medical advisors, I guess they call it a tribunal, but it doesn't have the ability to sanction people. If this medical tribunal saw fit to extend an offer of treatment, that offer would be made, which is a far more enlightened way of proceeding here. Granted, this is the sort of thing that should be carried out as any charitable or eleemosynary outreach should be carried out as a private function, but this is a far better approach than the quasi-totalitarian strictures that exist here in the supposed land of the free. And since this policy went into effect 10 years ago, Portugal has seen a marked decline not only in the incidental violence of the drug trade, they've seen a rapid and notable decline in the use of drugs, the rate of the use of drugs, almost all drugs, in almost every age group, and a notable decline in the rate of drug addiction. I don't know if that's because they've removed the cachet from drug use. It's no longer forbidden. It's no longer the forbidden fruit. And perhaps that has dimmed the allure of drug use for many people. But more importantly, they've seen a really rapid decline and a pronounced reduction in the violence carried out by those involved in counter-narcotics enforcement. It's been the best of all worlds. Now, unfortunately, this individual from Roy, Utah, a 45-year-old, what is his name here? They're not even mentioning his name. come in. 45-year-old Todd Blair doesn't live in a relatively enlightened place like Portugal, at least as far as narcotics policy is concerned. I'm sure that Roy, Utah is enlightened in many ways. Unfortunately, it's part of a country that is significantly unenlightened in matters of criminalizing bad personal choices. And they have a narcotics task force that is in the business of canvassing people, usually paid informants, liars for hire, for anonymous accusations they can use to obtain no-knock search warrants in pursuit of people who have quantities of narcotics, supposedly, that are sufficient to suggest an intent to distribute. Now, once again, you're dealing here with a crime that doesn't involve violence, doesn't involve fraud, it involves bad personal choices. There's no reason on earth, apart from the imperatives of officer safety and the convenience of prosecutors, to go for a no-knock search warrant. But they obtained a no-knock search warrant so that the subject of their investigation would not have time to destroy the evidence. And the perishability of the evidence, by the way, is one of the really good indications here that we're dealing with a perfectly stupid public policy. As a result, they surprised this guy in his home. There are two police officers. They're both armed. This guy comes up from his basement armed with a golf club. Don't you think that there are ways that two reasonably fit grown men working for, or employed by, I don't want to say working in connection with any kind of government occupation, employed by the police department can subdue a 45-year-old man with a golf club that don't involve perforating his body with gunfire? Well, not according to Chief Windham of the Roy Police. Chief Windham says he believes the officer's actions were justified and says if put in the same situation, he would have done the same thing. If you take whatever the club might be, the mechanism, golf club, pipe, axe handle, it doesn't matter to me, he says. The fact is, what can be the result, and in this case the result could have caused a lot of serious injury and potentially death to that officer or others that were trying to do what we have them do in our communities. Now, somewhere in this porridge of syllables, there's a sentence screaming to get out. And if I understand his meaning correctly, that sentence would be roughly the following. It doesn't matter what the subject of this raid had by way of an implement with which he could strike a police officer. The fact that he had it meant that he was in possession of a deadly weapon or a potentially deadly weapon. That being the case, it was justifiable for my officer to shoot him three times in spite of the fact that the implement the subject had in his hands wouldn't normally be considered a deadly weapon. Of course, that's nonsense on stilts. Pretty much anything that is in the hands of somebody who is targeted for lethal violence by a police officer can be defined as a lethal weapon. I'll explain why that's the case. Beneath all this discussion of officer safety, the nasty little secret here is the fact that the police carry firearms and the police are afraid that in an altercation with the mundane, the latter might end up in possession of the firearm. That is to say, they consider their own firearms to be a threat to officer safety, which is why they demand complete, unqualified, unconditional, passive, torpid, docile submission anytime there's an encounter between the police and a citizen, whether you're talking about a traffic stop, whether you're talking about a visit from an animal control officer, you're talking about an encounter with a parking attendant, a meter maid, or a meter man, I guess it would be. If you're dealing with somebody who has a government-issued firearm, there's this sense of vulnerability that the firearm somehow inflicts on the law enforcement officer, because there's always this gnawing fear that if the officer doesn't strike first in any situation in which he or she feels him or herself to be in peril to any degree, that the subject of their attention is going to rally and somehow end up in possession of that firearm. Well, of course, the obvious solution here is to disarm the cops. I'm all for that form of disarmament. It's not civilian disarmament. It's disarmament of one element of the most dangerous segment of any society. It's the targeted disarmament of that element in society most likely to commit large-scale crimes against persons and property. That's a point that was made, ironically enough, by a delegate from one of the African countries during the 2001 United Nations Conference on Small Arms and Light Weapons at UN headquarters that I attended as research for my book Global Gun Grab. This individual was puzzled that so little attention had been paid to the fact that most of the gun violence in the world, at least in that part of the world, Africa, which is a huge continent, much larger than North America, most of the gun violence was committed by people in the employ of government. Why weren't they on the receiving end of hostile scrutiny with respect to the possession of firearms, he asked. Well, that's because the whole point of what the United Nations was trying to accomplish was civilian disarmament. And darned if our own government isn't thinking along those same lines here. Thus ends Hour 2 of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. I'd sure love it if you'd join us. It'd be great to hear from you. 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a few, so stick around.